Wahino Amadunai Eloheno Aleno Ma'asedeno Kununa Aleno Ma'asedeno Kununeho. Shalom Aleichem, Baruchim Abayim. Welcome everyone. Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to now start our lesson in Genesis, chapter 5, Sefer Bereshit, in the fifth parak. We're going to begin our discussion with the genealogies that discuss the life as it proceeded from Adam. We're going to go through the genealogies. We're going to discuss how people lived the long, long lives. And then when we get to the eighth generation, which is really the seventh generation from Adam, we're going to stop and we're going to talk about a very interesting character whose name in Hebrew is Chanoch ben Yared, Enoch. In three verses here, from verse 21 through verse 24 here in the fifth chapter, it speaks about Enoch. And these three verses, which just speak about him in a passage coming and going, and that's it. These three verses have become, if you will, an entire, I can't even think of the proper word, foundation, change of course of such a tremendous amount of the Judaic tradition that indeed it actually laid the foundations of what I can call spiritual Christianity. This character of Enoch and what has been built upon him is so profound that it literally has changed the entire course of religion as we know it. We're going to get to that, and that's going to be the majority of this lesson. But before, let's go through our verses here in chapter 5. The verse opens almost as if it's like a review now of what we've been discussing. Up until now, chapter 4, we discussed the sons of Cain. We discussed their part of the world and what they did. Now, we're shifting to discuss the other son or sons of Adam, which came through Seth. This is the book of the generations of Adam. On the day that God created man, he made him in his likeness. He created the male and female. He blessed them and named them man on that day that they were created. Just as a side note here, we should know the term man in Hebrew Adam is not a term denoting gender. It is actually neutral. There is no man, the Zohar states, without the appropriate union of male and female. Or in other words, no one merits the title man unless he's married. So you cannot have a single man, but you may have a single male. In order to be a man, both male and female must be united. So a male's wife is as much a man as he is. The term man indicates a comprehensive integration of male and female personality attributes, the likes of which are discussed in later mystical Kabbalistic literature, what we call the Ten Sefirot, which are actually attributes of personality divided between masculine and feminine orientations. And we all know, biologically, the only real difference between male and female is, I believe, one simple chromosome. Psychologically speaking, we know that every man has an inner woman, and every woman has an inner man. These are what is referred to in Jungian psychology as the anima and the animus. And it is through the process of marriage that the wife activates and teaches the man about his inner woman, and the man activates and teaches the woman about her inner man. Male and female, really, I should say. This is the whole process of creation, the whole purpose behind marriage, and why we consider promiscuity to be an imbalance of that, why we consider just any kind of male-female coupling, which is not a bonding, just not to be an appropriate expression to fulfill this psychological necessity, spiritual necessity. And that is the whole purpose underlying marriage. And the form or function of a ceremony of marriage for Jews is outlined by our Jewish law, and for non-Jews is outlined within the context of whatever customs or laws are acceptable within the context of those individual communities. It's the bond, however, between the couple. While there is, obviously, the allowance of divorce, divorce should not be considered to be an option because of incompatibility or disagreements or uncomfortability or all the other garbage reasons people use. A bond between a male and a female that creates a man is sacred and is meant to work through the psychological issues that each of us individually have. Moving right along, it said Adam lived 130 years and he had a son in his likeness and form, and he named him Seth. Now, if you remember from our previous lessons, the most ancient of Hebrew Aramaic translations slash commentaries that we have on the Torah from Yonatan ben Uziel, he stated that Cain was actually the son of the serpent. He reiterates here, when the text says Adam had a son in his likeness, to stipulate again that Cain was not that son. That Seth here was actually the first living son that comes now, because prior to this, Adam's other son in his image, Abel, as we know, was murdered. And according to our Torah traditions, during the 130 years from Abel to Seth, Adam and Eve both had been copulating with the other species that were there at the time, which created entire races which were, if you will, not completely purely human. In the mystical tradition, they said that they were actually copulating with demonic elements. Some interpret that to have been spiritual. Others interpret it in a different way, which takes us into completely different and more frightening realms of subhuman types of entities living in the traditional inner earth. But that takes us into other teachings that we've discussed in other lessons. Our text does not expand on that, and therefore I want to stay true to our text and not go into all of those legends. I discussed those in other places. Getting back to our text. Adam lived 800 years after Seth, and he had sons and daughters. How many, we don't know. In all the days of Adam, he lived 930 years, and then he died. You remember, God said to Adam, on the day you eat of the tree of the forbidden fruit, the fruit of the forbidden tree, on that day you will die. Well, it's been 930 years. Is that the day? Remember the verse in Psalms where we say that the day of Hashem, the day of the Lord, is like 1,000 years. 930 years is still within the one day of 1,000 years. So therefore, he did die on that day. And indeed, within traditional biblical prophetic messianic prophecies, we are taught that the 6 days of creation somehow reflect the 6,000 years of creation. And that just like the world is created in 6 days, so it will only last 6 days, each one being 1,000 years. So that by the Hebrew year 6,000, the sin of Adam is to have been rectified, which means the coming of the Messiah. At the time of this lesson, we are now in the recorded Hebrew year 5,767. In our mystical traditions of the Zohar, it is taught that the Messiah will indeed not only come by the year 6000, but before the year 6000, that God will shorten the time. And even though this is a Zohar tradition from the days of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which is from about 50 to 100 years almost after the destruction of the Holy Temple in the year 70, we find similar echoes of this teaching even in earlier apocalyptic literature, even, if you will, echoed into the Christian traditions, wherein which it states in their apocalyptic teachings that the end of days, I believe what they call the tribulation, were to be lessened and shortened, otherwise no flesh would survive. So, how much shorter? No one really knows. But we know that we're in that time of imminent occurrence of something bizarre. And looking at world history today, who knows if the words I'm speaking right now will prove prophetic by the time people listen to this lesson years from now. Who knows? Moving right along. Seth lived 105 and he had a son, Enosh. Seth lived 807 years after he had Enosh, and he had sons and daughters. All the days of Seth, 912 years, and he died. Enosh lived 90 years, and he had a son, Kenan. Kenan lived 815 years, and after he had Kenan, he had sons and daughters. All of Enosh's days, 905 years, and he died. Kenan lived 70 years, and he had Mahalalel. Kenan lived 840 years after he had Mahalalel, and he had sons and daughters, and all of Kenan's days were 910 years, and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years, and he had a son, Yered. Mahalalel lived 830 years, and he had Yered, he had sons and daughters. All of Mahalalel's years were 895 years, and he died. Yered lived 162 years, and he had a son, Enoch, of whom we're going to speak so much about in a minute. Yered lived 800 years after he had Enoch, and he had sons and daughters. All of Yered's days were 962 years, and he died. Now, we're listening to all these guys living 900 years. Is this literal? Did these people really live that long? Gee, what kind of prune juice were they drinking? What was in their diet? A big controversy in biblical interpretation, wherein which you have the likes of Maimonides, who will state, no, everybody in those days, they lived normal lives, and the reason why these individuals are spoken of individually in the Torah is because only they had length of days. And that's why they're enumerated here. That's his opinion, which not everybody accepts. A more majority opinion is that in the days before the flood, indeed, longevity was natural. And why? Because humanity at this time was genetically different than we are today. Now this is a very interesting point. Originally, the way the world was before the flood, according to our traditional sources, was rather different as it is today. The environment was different. The temperature was different. Allegedly, the axis of the earth was different. The continental grouping was different. Our scientists today say that continental drift happens over periods of millions of years. But they're also very well aware that geological and climatic changes can occur that can make what happens normally, what we would think, over millions of years happen over a period of individual days. So, our scientists have recognized that at one time the land mass was all one time joined together in what they called a supercontinent of Pangaea. They believe that was like millions and millions of years ago. And that over a period of millions and millions of years, it shifted into the present state of continents. I believe modern science will have to acknowledge that there is the possibility. They will not claim it's true, but they have to acknowledge the possibility that such radical shifts could occur in an extremely much quicker time. Now, in our next lesson, we'll talk about the flood. We'll talk about how the flood could have occurred, what God could have done in the order and nature of the universe and the world to have created such a climatic change. But right now, to discuss the way things were, mankind lived a much longer life. During this time, all of humanity, in spite of however violent they were all vegetarian. No one ate meat. Is that related to the aspect of longevity? It's very possible. I cannot say or I cannot deny, but it's possible. I don't say this as a point to recommend vegetarianism. I certainly don't. I'm not a vegetarian. I don't support vegetarianism. And I point to those who consider vegetarianism to be a higher spiritual state, that the only time that the world in total was vegetarian was so evil and wicked that God had to destroy it. That's not exactly a vote of confidence in vegetarianism in my book. But anyway, the people in these days still had a rather radically different environment in which they lived. And that environment made their life different. Now, there is some very interesting Midrashic tales which speak about the genetic differences. Now, I'm jumping ahead a little when I discuss this, but I'm going to mention it now. We'll discuss it more when we just talk about Noah and the flood. A very ancient Jewish legend states that when Noah was born, it says, oh, this one's going to bring us comfort. And the question they asked was, why? And they said that during the days prior to Noah, all humanity were born with webbed fingers, that we had flesh connecting our individual fingers, and we had like a webbed reptilian style hand. And Noah was the first born with what today is a human hand. And that was a sign to the people of their generation. Now, if there's any literal truth to this, this is only one of the signs of a genetic distinction between modern man and pre-flood man. What exactly that is, I cannot say. But I do believe the majority opinion of our sages who teach that this longevity was quite literal, and that things were different then. The orbit of the earth was different. And indeed, we say, as we're going to discuss with Noah and the flood, one of the ways or results, if you will, of the flood was a tilting of the axis of the earth, which brought us into our present state. And that when Mashiach comes and we rectify the sins of Adam, one of the great changes upon the earth will be the restoration of how things originally were, which it again would mean a shifting of the earth's axis, possibly orbit. We have documented geological evidence of the magnetic poles shifting north and south. What that would do to our technology, what would that do to our inner biological correlations to the earth, is unknown. It's happened before, and it's destined to happen again. All of these things are what was before the flood, and what will be again before Mashiach. Now, each of these individuals mentioned here are not obviously the first child of each. So when we mentioned Seth, Seth's son is Enosh. Did they have other sons before Enosh? Very possible. It's not like he waited until he was to the age of 105 and then he got married. He could have gotten married at 20 and had 20 kids before. But Enosh was a significant child in that respect. And it said he had many other sons and daughters. Doesn't say he didn't have any before. So therefore, we have to understand within the context of the text that each of these people listed was as if a leader of the generation. One who received, if you will, a passage of information and knowledge. Each one, if you will, was like the high priest of his generation. the king of righteousness of his time. He could have had many other brothers and sisters before and after, but each one of these was significant. And that's all we have to know. Now, if you would ever to look at the timelines of all the years that these people have lived, Adam, we say, was year one. In Jewish tradition, we say that the Hebrew holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, was not the celebration of the day of creation of the world, but the day of the celebration of the creation of man. Adam's birthday was Rosh Hashanah. What was before then, we don't know. So from day one of our calendar of how we date things is from Adam. Of all the people who lived, believe it or not, it was only, Noah was the first one who was born after Adam died. Enoch, for example, was born hundreds of years before Adam died. And all of these people, very possibly, obviously must have had relations with all of the previous generations. It's very possible that Enoch went and studied with, lived with, learned with Adam himself, and had access to the information and knowledge that Adam was able to bring forth with him from his original state. Now, all these people come, live, and die. Until now, we come to this one. Enoch lived 65 years, and he had his son Methuselah. Methuselah is the one who lived the longest, but we'll talk about him later. Enoch walked with God for 300 years after he had Methuselah. He had sons and daughters, and all of Enoch's days were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was no more, because God had taken him. God had taken him. What does that mean? Well, according to later Jewish tradition, I mean, he died like everybody else. And the classic Bible commentary called Rashi, it states a later tradition, I'm emphasizing later because we're going to get to the earlier traditions in a minute, that Enoch was a righteous and holy man who had decided in his heart that he was going to become wicked, and there to protect him from that, God had him die prematurely. And that being that he is the first to have died prematurely, that's why it's mentioned like this. Now, there's a good reason why this tradition arose in Judaism. It's because there was such a tidal wave of another tradition, which is so profound that has had such a radical effect on world religion, that indeed, our sages pretty much wanted to downplay it. Now we have to discuss the secrets of Enoch. In order to do that, we have to now understand a little bit about Jewish history. In the book of Exodus, God takes the Jewish people out of Egypt. Moses calls to God and says, God, please lead us in the desert, bring us to the Holy Land. God says, behold, I will send an angel before you. He will go before you, listen to him, don't mess with him. My name is within him. And indeed, this special angel of God was given a special name called Metatron. Metatron actually is a Greek word, it means the guardian. He's the angel of the Lord. Moses says, God, we want you to lead us, not an angel. God says, fine. All during the days of the wilderness, they are led by God himself. They come to the land, and in Joshua, I believe the fifth chapter, he sees this heavily armed man standing. Joshua's ready to pull his sword. He says, who are you, friend or foe? And he says, I am the angel of the Lord. I have now come to guide you into the land. Joshua recognized, angel of the Lord, this is Metatron, who in other traditions is also referred to as Michael. Yes, Michael and Metatron are one and the same. This is clearly stated in an ancient Jewish book called Sefer Zerubbabel, and is known in many other sources. Now, moving through history, God's presence is with the Jewish people. We have the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Presence, building of the Temple. All is great until we sin.
God sends Nebuchadnezzar, temple is destroyed, ark is concealed, here we are in exile. What do we find happening in exile? Daniel. Daniel, who is not a prophet, nowhere in the book of Daniel does it say, and the Lord spoke to Daniel saying, command to the children of Israel, etc. We find that with Daniel's contemporary, Ezekiel, but not with Daniel. And that's why the book of Daniel in the Jewish compilation of the Bible is not put in the second section of the prophets, it's put in the third section called the writings. Daniel communed with the angels. Daniel saw that in the days of exile, where the hand of God was being concealed, it would be concealed through the movement of God's angels. Who are these angels? The watcher angels, who are called in the book of Daniel the Irwa Kadosh, the Irin, the watchers, the guides. These same watchers now are said to be in charge of humanity. An interesting concept that the book of Daniel introduces to us. But nowhere does this end with the book of Daniel. After the book of Daniel, an entire genre of Jewish literature blossoms onto the world. And I say onto the world because it wasn't just limited to Judaism. The nations of the world jumped on these books, adopted these books, and it's indeed from this genre that the entire Christian tradition came forth. And many things from even Islam came from these. This is what's today in the academic circles are called apocalyptic literature. Daniel was revealed to him what the history and course of the second temple times would be. He had visions of the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and everything else, giving a warning to the people. Get your act right, and the course of history will go one way. If the people continue to sin, the course of history will go in another way. And those are the secrets of the book of Daniel. I've described and taught all of them in my course on the book of Daniel, which I have available through, of course, koshertorah.com. I recommend people learn this well. But out of this genre of literature, many people like Daniel began to practice the old prophetic traditions of what's called Aliyah. The ascent, just like Ezekiel taught in the first chapter of how he went into his prophetic state and he saw the chariot vision, the Merkavah. Ezekiel wasn't the only one who could do this. This was performed by thousands and thousands of Torah faithful Jews, Daniel amongst them. Many others had received revelations and books just like Ezekiel, just like Daniel. The word prophecy, but there were insights into the spiritual operations of the world. And of these revelations, they came in contact with the watchers, the Irin, who revealed to them the operations of the world, both present, their present, future, our days, and the past. These angels revealed to them the true secrets of Genesis 5 and 6. They revealed to them who the sons of God were who came down to take the daughters of men. All of this knowledge was known only to the elite in the days when Moses wrote it. But now, thousands of years later, when the connection with God directly was gone, but we had connection with the angels, it was from this same group of angels that the fall occurred. Those are the same angels from their band who came down to earth. And now we reached up and touched them. And they made us aware of what was going on in the world. And it's from that profound revelation that changed the entire course of Judaism and brought to us what we today call the mystical tradition, what we call the Kabbalah. This is where it all came from. And they had a tradition about Enoch, which they revealed to us, which has again changed the entire course of religion. Enoch did not die. He ascended to heaven. He was taken from mankind and translated, just like Elijah was, historically, years later, where he went up in a chariot of fire. These angels, the watchers revealed, and an entire body of apocalyptic literature called the Books of Enoch taught how Enoch ascended and became this angel Metatron. Indeed, Yonatan ben Uziel in his commentary, his translation, states this clearly. Enoch ascended. God took him above and made him the head of the angels, the chief of the angels. He was the seventh generation from Adam. Adam being, if you count the zero, Enoch would be seven. Enoch, our traditions teach us, separated from the world. He was the first Perushi, if you will. And bonded with God to, in essence, rectify the sin of Adam as best as he could. God was so impressed with his endeavors that he says, you know, just as good as you are with man, you could be good with these watchers. I hereby promote you to heaven. I'm going to translate you physically. You're going to be their boss. And Metatron became the head of the angels. He became called the Sahraba, the heavenly scribe, the one who sits at God's right hand. He's called God's right-hand man. And this is a very important concept to understand. In the Talmud, it is said that one of the great sages had a vision of heaven, wherein which he saw God sitting on his throne and all the angels around him, with only one angel sitting at the right side. Sitting, if you will, taking notes. And he goes, is this a second God? And that sin caused him to be punished. Because no, obviously it wasn't. But this is the angel of the Lord, God's representative. For those of you who come from a non-Jewish, specifically a Christian background, much of this might be sounding suspicious to you. And indeed it should. Because it is this character, as it developed in apocalyptic literature, which became the foundation of the spiritual understanding of the character of Yeshu underlying Christianity. And on this point, we now have to elaborate. In the apocalyptic literature, Metatron, Michael, is seen as this great and powerful angel. The one who is going to lead the armies of God against all the forces of evil in the world. He is a profound spiritual individual. And there's an interesting correlation here. The prophet Ezekiel is given a specific and strange title in the prophetic book. He's called Ben Adam, son of man. What does that mean? He's called Ben Adam, the son of the first man, because Ezekiel, through his prophetic sense and experience, was able to truly correlate his soul, like Seth, to be in the image of Adam. And as such, being in that pure and refined image, he's called the son of man, son of Adam. That's what the term meant. We are taught that the Messiah, the Mashiach, and exactly what his role and function is, we have to discuss later. I'll get to that. Is also to be called the son of Adam, Ben Adam, because he too is to be in the true image of Adam, before the contamination of the human DNA with the sons of God, fallen angels. This character, spoken of in apocalyptic literature, of a coming king, a human being, nowhere does it say born of a virgin, or any of that other kind of pagan teachings. It is emphatically stated that he is to be born of a human being. And who are we talking about? The coming king of Israel. On these days, remember I said that Daniel predicted that during the second temple days, history could have gone in one of two ways. If they go in the way of Hashem, things will follow the course as pretty much outlined in the book of Zechariah and all those other later prophecies. If not, then we're going to go into a long other course, as the book of Daniel describes. Well, during the days of the Second Temple, before the, if you will, cards were dealt, everyone knew that the potential existed for the restoration of the Davidic household in the coming of a king. This king, what was his intentions, his purpose in coming? Nowhere in Judaic literature do we find it stated that the coming king was to come to save people from their sins, wash them and atone for them, or any of these other pagan concepts. This is totally outside the parameter of that original historical teachings. And therefore, it was foreign, alien, and pagan, even to Yeshu, the historical person himself. He would never have thought of to like this. If he even considered himself historically to have been Messiah, he never would have thought of himself to have been that kind of Messiah, because that's not what Messiah was. A Messiah, the Hebrew word Messiah means Mashiach, which means an anointed one. What are you anointed for? You are anointed to be a king. What does a king do? He is a political leader. Spiritual leadership was always in the hands of the priesthood, never in the hands of the king. That's a distinction that must always be understood. The king was a political leader. And what was the specific authority of the king, as you learn from the law? To declare war. So the entire purpose of having a Mashiach, a king, was to have an identifiable political authority who would have the Torah law to declare war against the enemies of Israel, raise an army, cleanse the land, and do what was right. Now, originally, as we know, a couple hundred years before the days of Yeshua, the Maccabees came and did this. Problem with the Maccabees was they were priests, they were Kohens, they were the spiritual leaders of the people. They should not have been the physical political leaders. And because of them violating their parameters, we see the second generation of the Maccabees became completely corrupted. They became the enemies of our sages who spoke up against their corruption. Our sages were literally hunted down and murdered by the descendants of the Maccabees, who themselves became the Hellenized form of what they themselves warred against. They're the ones who invited in the Romans. The people were so oppressed that ultimately the Maccabean clan was wiped out, and a non-Jew sat on the throne of Israel, Herod. And it was in his days that the people cried out for a king in Israel. It is in these circumstances that this apocalyptic literature flowered. People were desperate, looking for spiritual signs. Very similar to today, I should add. And throughout those days, people had the meditative training to speak with the angels, who were telling them what was to be, what could become, saying how this great and mighty angel of Metatron could incarnate on earth. It's not like the first time angels ever came to earth. And therefore, you would know the Messiah because he would be the incarnation of this powerful angel. That is what the original apocalyptic teachings taught. We find later in Kabbalistic literature a similar teaching. We find that at Mount Sinai, Moses was taught by a specific angel whose name was Zagzagkel. And Yonatan ben Uzziel, of all people, states this was Moses' angelic teacher. We learn from other sources that this angel was one of the many names given to Metatron. That Metatron, if you will, was Moses' rabbi in heaven, the angel of the Lord, who was none other than Enoch. Enoch, therefore, was Moses' rebbe. Now, our sages say, well, what's the relationship here? For those who understand the mystical Kabbalistic secrets of the levels of soul, recognize souls are not isolated individuals, but actually they're like somehow united with one another, composites. And in the mystical teachings, we are taught that as Moses was the first Redeemer who brought us out of Egypt, so would Moses be the Messiah in the end of days. But it says it's not just Moses, it's actually the secret soul, or the higher soul of Moses, who would be the Messiah. And we are taught that when an individual ascends above to heaven, they are taught by none other than their own higher self as it resides in heaven. You're not being taught by someone else, you're being taught by you. In other words, you're connecting to your own inner higher self. Moses' higher self was this angel. Moses' higher self was Enoch. In essence, in a way, it was his previous incarnation, and therefore will be his future incarnation. So the inner higher self of Moses will reincarnate to be Messiah in the end of days. But again, what the people were looking for in their days was not a supernatural being to come down from heaven, but a human being born of the earth who would have this tremendous power and authority to establish the political order. This is what the people were looking for in the days of Yeshua. And therefore, why he was referred to also as the Son of Man, using the Ezekiel term that his followers claimed and believed about him, that he was of that spiritual stature, that he was also like a refined human being. Whether he was or not of Davidic bloodline, his followers claim that he was the true authoritative house of David, who could therefore claim the kingship of Israel. And if they were to ascribe messianic applications to that, it wasn't some spiritual nonsense of pagan origins. It was a clear and definitive political statement. And nothing becomes clearer than if we study the history of the original followers of Yeshua, James, Peter, the original, what they called church, what they were involved in. We see that this is clear. Paul, who came from the outside, introduced a pagan spiritualization of the Yeshua concept, which Yeshua's original followers, his own family, rejected. Yeshua himself never made these pagan origins. Indeed, the difference between our rabbis and Yeshua wasn't so much spiritual. Our rabbis never rejected him for claiming that he was Messiah or anything of the kind. He was rejected specifically because of his political claims. Yeshua, by his followers believing him to be the king, was saying, we are the true political authority, you got to follow what we say, and we say, declare war on Rome. And as a point made very clear in the Talmudic tradition documented in Tractate Gittin, the group that declared war on the Romans were called the Birionim, and they were clearly the original followers of Yeshua. They were warlike, violent. We see this clearly in Yeshua himself. Think not that I've come to bring peace, I've come to bring a sword. Christian apologists for centuries have tried to dismiss this as how he's speaking spiritually. But Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane, when allegedly Yeshua was come to be arrested, I guess he didn't understand that spiritual connection, because he had a physical blade. And he used it rather quickly. And he was able to cut off a guy's ear. I thought Peter was a fisherman. What's he doing with a sword? I thought he was a man of peace. How come he's so quick to use it? And how come he could be so proficient that he knew how to detach any body part with such proficiency? This is a symbol of a violent man. When Yeshua was allegedly crucified, because we don't necessarily believe that that story was historically accurate, the Christian tradition states that he was crucified between two, if you look at the original Greek word, it means, if you will, political agitators, what today we would call terrorists. Yeshua's crime clearly was political. It had nothing to do with spiritual. It's political. This is the true nature of the Messiah and what a Messiah was supposed to have been. What the apocalyptic literature was predicting. And this is the entire foundation of Enoch. So, we go into Enochian literature. There are three texts brought down to us that we still have to this day called Enochian literature. Books of Enoch, 1, 2, and 3. The first and second books of Enoch were lost to the Jewish communities for millennia. Rabbi Chaim Vital, the great Kabbalist in the 16th century, in his commentary to the Zohar, actually quotes one of the books of Enoch, called First Enoch today, and he specifically states this is the book found in non-Jewish hands written in the non-Jewish language. Meaning, it was originally in the old, I think, Greek or Coptic. Now, in modern times, in the discoveries of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have found original Aramaic texts of the book of Enoch, the first. The second book of Enoch is a mystery. Some even claim that Yeshua himself wrote it. The third Enoch we have had in Jewish traditions for millennia. It is a tradition where one of the great sages called Rabbi Ishmael was able to ascend to heaven to speak with Metatron, and Metatron gave him an entire body of teachings of ascent called the Book of the Palaces or the Hechalot. And this became the foundations and fundamentals of Jewish mysticism and the Kabbalah. We find similar teachings now in the original Aramaic Enoch. The books of Enoch are referred to tremendously throughout the Zohar. So this body of teachings revolving around Enoch has played a fundamental role in the continuation of the Torah teachings. And again, from here we see, from this apocalyptic literature, the entire spiritual concept of Christianity developed, wherein which you had a supernatural Messiah who was not to come for supernatural purposes, but for political. So I reiterate, nowhere in Enochian literature for the coming of Metatron being a Messiah do we ever find a reference to death and a resurrection, atonement of sins. All of this is pagan in origin. All of this comes from Paul and accommodations made to Gentile sources. And those who want to point to this or that verse in our Jewish Bible to make this or that claim can do everything they want, because you know you can make the Bible read any which way you want. You can point to me Isaiah 53 about the suffering servant all you want, but that clearly is speaking about the entire Jewish community, the entire nation of Israel. And you could say, but some say it refers to the Messiah too. To which the obvious response is, but of course it does. The Messiah is the King of Israel. And does not the king and the people share the same fate? Because Isaiah 53 speaks of the nation of Israel, it will also speak of its king. It's not speaking of a king at the exclusion of the nation, or speaking of the nation because of the king. It speaks of the king because he's part of the nation. So it's important for us to understand this Enochian teachings, to recognize Metatron and who and what he is, and where these teachings have been accepted and taught properly, and unfortunately where they spiraled out of control. Because in the Christian tradition, unfortunately coming from their pagan origins, when they hear this super special angel in heaven, the one who could sit at God's right hand, who's the angel of the Lord. What does that mean? That he must be an expression of God, a son of God, and who comes and becomes flesh and dwells among us. This is where that concept of the duality, which has always been the source of Christian idolatry, that a human being, God, has become a human being and dwells among us. This is a mistaken understanding. Enoch was a human being who became an angel and who only returned to the human race. He serves as God's messenger But he is not God. We say God's name is within him. What does that mean? Not that he's God, but rather he has God's authority. Comparatively, if the President of the United States were to personally send me as his ambassador, I represent the President and I would represent the United States. The name of the President would be within me. I would be carrying his authority. Am I the President? No. Can I speak for the President? Only what I'm told to say. Big difference between the two. But this, in the pagan mentality, which was predominant in the Greco-Roman world, where in which they had the history, and we'll talk about this in the next lesson about Noah, speaks of the sons of God who came down, and these are the men of renown. And the ancient traditions of the nations of the world, the Norse, the Greeks, they had the lessons of the gods who lived on Olympus. I am of the opinion that there might have been an actual historical foundation, that these entities might have been the fallen angels and their progeny, who had abilities, both biologically and certainly technologically, that would have made them for sure appear to be as gods to the people of their day. So the people had this idea that you could have a god who was a person who was a god. And it's that mentality, that psyche that stayed with them and applied to this angel of the Lord, Metatron, who they thought also was somehow divine. And this was their mistaken concept of the original apocalyptic teaching. And that's why I believe this is very important that historically we recognize and understand what has happened here, not, God forbid, as an attack upon the Christian faith, but rather as a revelation of truth, so that people can build bridges rather than burn them. And a point that I just want to make off the cuff here. In the Christian book of Hebrews, there's a reference that states that Yeshu was a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. As I mentioned to you earlier, he is supposed to have been a political leader, and that the spiritual authority is in the hands of the priesthood. You can point to Hebrews 11 and say, aha, here he is, the spiritual authority. Well, we have to understand exactly what that meant. You see, based upon the verse where it says David was of the order of the priesthood of Melchizedek, and that's in a way true too. But what was the priesthood of Melchizedek? I've been talking about it all during this lesson. These individuals who we've been talking about, the leaders of their generation, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Yered, they were Melchizedekian priests. Wait a second, Melchizedek, isn't he the guy from Jerusalem we read about in the days of Abraham? Yes, but let me explain. You see, when God banished Adam, he also gave Adam teachings, a set of a body of learning, of laws, spiritual practices, which were to be taught to the nations. This is indicative within the biblical text, even though it's not said. This is the foundation of what we call the universal spiritual principles, or what we refer to in Talmudic literature as the seven laws of the children of Noah. Why do we call them the children of Noah? In all the respects, really the children of Adam. It's only that once they were wiped out and Noah was left, it got named after Noah. Adam received the body of teachings, not to murder, committing adultery, stealing, all these things which we see that the people of the generation were condemned for. Why were they condemned for? Obviously because they knew it was wrong. How did they know it was wrong? Because they were taught. Where in the Bible does it say that? It doesn't really have to say that outright. It's indicated. That's how we learn these things. One of the angels who was actually related to Metatron, whose name was Raziel, the secrets of God, gave Adam these teachings. And Adam passed it on to Seth, who passed it on to Enosh, who passed it on to Kenan. Each of these were, if you will, the high priest. The ones who were in charge of the teachings. The ones who were responsible. They passed on these teachings. They were the kings of righteousness. Enoch was one of these as well. He passed it on to his son, who passed on to his son, who passed on to Noah. Noah, in turn, passed it on to his son, Shem. Shem passed it on to his great-grandson, Eber, who passed it on to Abraham. Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to his family, who becomes the children of Israel. So you see, this is why it's explained in the book of Exodus why God calls Israel a nation of priests. This is why God chose the nation of Israel to be the Melchizedekian priests, to teach the spiritual lessons to the world, and to suffer accordingly, according to Isaiah 53. So this is the history of the Melchizedekian priesthood. This is why all of Israel are Melchizedekian priests. Why King David, the leader of the people, is the political leader and therefore the spiritual one to teach the nations. And indeed, that is the role also of Messiah, to bring the Torah of truth to the world. So therefore, in the book of Hebrews, when it says that Yashki was a Melchizedekian priest, all that meant was that he was a Jew who had political obligations. Because the true spiritual obligations of teaching Torah wasn't given to the entire Melchizedekian priesthood, but only a small portion of them. Of the Melchizedekian priesthood, there was the priesthood of the priesthood, the cream of the crop chosen. Of the Melchizedekian priesthood, which is the entire nation of Israel, one tribe was chosen, Levi. And of that tribe of Levi, one family was chosen, the family of Aaron, the brother of Moses. They were called the Kohanim, the Aaronic priesthood. They were the cream of the crop. In Christian and unfortunately Mormon tradition, they look at the Aaronic priesthood as being less than the Melchizedekian. From their non-Jewish perspective, maybe they're right. Because their connections through the Melchizedekian, which is the Jews, they don't see it like that. They've never received it like that. They've never understood it like that. But the truth, those closest to God are the priesthood of Aaron. And that's why in the Qumranic community, they called themselves the priests, the Levites, the sons of Sadok. They were looking for a Mashiach of Aharon, an Aaronic priest. And we learn, even in Talmudic tradition, that coming with Mashiach ben David, also comes a special one called the Kohen Tzedek, the righteous priest. He will serve as the Kohen in the rebuilt temple. Not Messiah. Messiah is a king. He's in Jerusalem. He's not in the temple. He's the Mashiach of Aharon, the Kohen Tzedek, spoken of in the Gemara, Masechet Moed Katan. He is the high priest. His job is to teach the Torah. Mashiach is to be the political leader. Even though the Mashiach is the embodiment of this powerful angel, the Son of Man, the angel of Hashem, God's representative. That's what he is. No supernatural, no metaphysical, no pagan things here. But this is the true understanding of who is Enoch. The secrets of Enoch. Getting back to our text, Enoch, as it says, walked with God. God took him up to heaven. He serves in heaven as the angel of Lord, and essences of his soul come down in each and every generation and become the sages of every generation to teach us. His son Methuselah lived 187 years. He had a son Lamech. Methuselah, he lived 782 years after he had Lamech. He had sons and daughters. He died at the age of 969, the oldest of them all. That's why we say, oh, you're as old as Methuselah. Lamech lived 182 years and he had a son named him Noah, saying, this one will bring us relief from our work and the anguish of our hands from the soil that God had cursed. Lamech lived 595 years after he had Noah. He had sons and daughters. All of Lamech's years was 777, and he died too. Thus ending chapter 5. Even though Noah is mentioned here, we'll discuss more about Noah as we get into our next lesson, because that is just his place. So on that note, let me conclude here. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen. Amen.